And hello there, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, February 21st, 2018. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today for the entire hour is Peter Heller. Peter is the best-selling author of The Painter and The Dog Stars. He holds an MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop in both fiction and poetry, an award-winning adventure writer and a longtime contributor to NPR. Peter is a contributing editor at Outside Magazine, Men's Journal and National Geographic Adventure, and a regular contributor to Bloomberg Businessweek. He's also the author of several nonfiction books, including Kuk, The Whale Warriors, and Hell or High Water, Surviving Tibet's Sango River. He lives in Denver, Colorado, and he's here primarily today to talk about his new novel, Selene. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
Good morning. Great to have you on. I'm your newest biggest fan, I think, and just love your stuff. I read Selene, and I had to go back and read Dog Stars. I didn't have time to read The Painter yet, and I want to. But let's begin with Selene. Talk about how that book came about.
My mom died 3 years ago, and I was devastated, and six months afterwards, I sat down to begin my new novel, and it began, I always start with the first line. I'm not so interested in outlining or plot or anything like that. We can talk about that later, but I came up through magazines and a lot of nonfiction work, and so in those stories, I always knew what was going to happen because it happened. I knew what was going to happen next. I knew the ending, and when I came to fiction, I sort of took that other hand from behind my back, gave the imagination free rein. I just didn't want to know. I wanted to have the thrill that the reader has, coming around the bend of a story and not knowing what was going to be there. And so I start with a first line, and this first line was something like, I'm mostly interested in the music, the language, and this was something like, "My mother's name was Amana Ambrosio. In Tupi Warani, Amana means night rain." And that's how I began. And it was the story of this young woman who had lost her mother very young. And then when she was in college, lost her father. And she didn't think that his death was ruled as a bear mauling outside of Yellowstone National Park, and she just didn't think the evidence added up. And so as I was writing along, she contacted a private eye who was specializing in cold cases and asking her for help in possibly finding her dad, if he was still alive. And this private eye, as I was writing, ended up being a lot like my mom. In fact, it was my mom. She lived in the same place, on the dock, under the Brooklyn Bridge, Brooklyn side, right there by the Brooklyn Bridge Park. If any of the listeners have been there, there's a building on the corner closest to the dock where lots of tourists flock to see that sort of great view of the skyline and the Brooklyn Bridge. She lives there in a studio where she's an artist. She makes sculptures out of bones. She makes voodoo altars. She's kind of a remarkable artist. She's kind of a blue blood, and she's a PI who's very good at finding missing people. And, that was my mom. And I realized as I was writing into the story that, that's what I really wanted to do. I really wanted to write about my mother because I missed her, and I wanted to spend the better part of another year with her.
Hmm. I love that. And I loved Selene. Reading this novel, one of the things that was refreshing was that Hank, her son, the son character in the book, actually loves his mother. Like mothers and mothers-in-law kind of get short shrift in fiction, it seems. And I just love that this was a beloved mother and an interesting older woman.
Yeah, well, Mom was, she was really special. And I didn't, in Selene, I didn't change her. I mean, all the backstory is true, all the family history. how she is in her life, how she speaks, what she, you know, thinks about, as I imagine and watch my mom, you know, all those years. You know, I wrote her as closely as I could, which was such a trip. I changed her name. My mom's name was Caroline, and I wanted a name that seemed, sort of sounded like that, and that might be a little French, because my mother, just like Celine, was born in Paris before the war, and you know, their backstories are all exactly the same. And then her husband and Watson, in solving all these cases, is Pete Beveridge, and I didn't change his name even. I just knew he wasn't going to sue me. So, but he is as written. I mean, he's 86 years old now, and you know, he loved the book.
Yeah, he was. He's such a great character. He was such a great character. Did you feel that you had to let him vet the novel or get his approval of the manuscript before you handed it in?
Oh, yeah. Oh, you know, I always do when there's somebody that I'm writing closely, especially. I mean, I didn't change his name, so you know. I had to send it to him, and it was really great when I did. So Pete is a seventh-generation Mainer, not just a Mainer, but a coastal Mainer, and not just a coastal Mainer, but an island Mainer. And this is a special breed. I mean, these guys, I think I said in the book that reticence is the state bird up there, and they don't say much. And in the family, we call Pete the quiet American. And they were a prodigious investigative team. They were sort of like good cop, bad cop, but like the one who talked and the one who didn't. But Pete, you know, he was a great listener, and he was so smart. You know, he'd gone to Harvard. He's a very interesting dude. He'd been a card-carrying communist in 1953. Can you imagine in college when it could really screw with your prospects? He just didn't do it. He could build boats. He could, you know, he grew up pitching hay on the island. You know, he was very self-sufficient. And the two of them together solved over 100 cases, but reuniting birth families is what they did mostly.
Hmm.
And so when I finished the book, I sent it to Pete, and I get a call a few days later. Hey, this is Pete. I read the book. Radio silence, right? We can't go on too long, and the listeners will turn off the radio. But say 5 or 6 beats, and I was like, oh, yeah, okay. He said, I have 2 criticisms. So I sat up, and he said, you know, the first is that your mother would have never gone out to meet the assassin when we were camping in her bathrobe with a Glock in the shoulder holster, carrying her cup of coffee without putting on full face. I was like, okay, phew. I think I can take care of that. I'd had her in the book just slap on some lipstick. And then he said, and you know, she never took my arm. We always held hands.
Oh.
And I thought that was so touching. So wow. I changed that too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that you're not interested in plot when you begin, because The two novels I've read of yours, this one, Celine, and The Dog Stars, they both move along at quite a clip. And so talk about how things progress for you in the writing. For Celine,
yeah.
How did it go then?
Well, but just to go back about this idea, you know, of not plotting and not outlining, you know, when I first had, I'd written for magazines for, you know, a couple of decades. I'd written 4 nonfiction books that grew out of those stories. You know, they were adventure, they were environmental books. And as I said, you know, when I came finally to write the novel I'd always wanted to write, I really wanted to surprise myself. I'd come up through kayaking. I was a passionate kayaker as a young guy, and that's how I got into magazine writing for outside at first. I was writing about, you know, radical kayak expeditions around the world. And what I loved about running rivers is that when you're on a river that hasn't been described or that you don't know at all, you know, you come around that tight bend and you don't know what's there. It could be a waterfall. It could be a cougar drinking. It could be a flight of swallows or some guys with bows and arrows, depending on what river you're on. And I just love that about paddling. And a novel is like a river. I mean, the narrative, you know, if you've got this narrative current, you put in and you travel into a country where, you know, for me, you know, I've never been before into this new territory and stuff happens. And so I love that. I wanted that sense of adventure when I was writing fiction, when I came to finally write fiction. So I didn't, you know, I read John Gardner's book on writing novels. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his whole plan was to make an outline and then just keep filling it in with smaller and smaller A's and 1s and 2s and A's and B's until you have a novel. And, you know, I thought, gosh, you know, if I was going to do that, you know, I might as well just be a lawyer. You know, I want to have as much fun as my reader. So when I came to sit down to write The Dog Stars, finally, you know, had my chance to write fiction, I called my buddy. I didn't know if it was, you know, even legal just to start with the first line and have no idea, you know, with like the fiction police bust down the door or something. I mean, I didn't know if anybody did that. And so I called my buddy Carlton Cues, and he was my best friend in high school and, you know, really dear friend. And he ended up being the producer for Lost, the TV show, and the showrunner and executive producer. And he's got like 4 TV shows on right now, and he's got the Jack Ryan series coming up. I mean, he's the most working producer in TV. And I called him and I said, hey, Carl Tony, you've worked with a lot of novelists. Do you know any who just start with the first line and have no clue? And he said, you know, he didn't hesitate. He said, yeah, you know, I've worked with Stephen King. He often starts with the first line. That's a voice. The voice is a character. The character's in a place. There's a situation because there's always a situation. And then he writes into the story. And then he said something that really surprised me. He said, I've worked with Elmore Leonard, and he often does the same thing. That, I thought, was truly remarkable, mm-hmm. because if you think about Elmore Leonard's novels, you know, they're these seemingly tightly plotted crime novels in South Florida, like Get Shorty, you know, all that stuff. And so that sort of gave me permission, and I sat down to write The Dog Stars in my coffee shop, and I wrote, I keep the beast running, I keep the low lead on tap, I foresee attacks. A few lines later, my name is Hig, one name, Big Hig if you need another. If I ever woke up crying in the middle of a dream, and I'm not saying I did, it's because the trout are gone, everyone. And as soon as he said that, you know, I just sort of sat up and I thought to myself, you know, I'm listening, you know, tell it. And then it was the most remarkable thing. It was like this guy was on the other side of a campfire for me on like an October night with the wind blowing the flames around. And he was telling me what happened to him a few years before. And it was the most thrilling thing I'd ever experienced. I mean, I've been on all these expeditions, I've been on adventures around the world, and this was the most amazing and thrilling experience I'd ever had. And so I would be in my coffee shop and I'd be writing along, and I'd laugh out loud, or I'd start crying. You know, I'd just start weeping. You know, the tears would be like dripping off my chin onto the table in the cafe. I know people were probably looking at me thinking, you know, that poor son of a bitch, he's going through a bad divorce, or he lost his dog or whatever, you know. So it was, you know, that amazing, amazing adventure. And so just to talk about the process and how it can change, you know, when I finished The Dog Stars, and I thought, this is good, you know, not to sound like like God, but I felt like I loved it. I loved the novel. And I thought maybe some other people will like it too. And if there's any kind of clamor at all, you know, good or bad, it's going to put a lot of pressure on the second book, because I'd heard of second novel syndrome, you know, and the sophomore effort, all of that. And I thought, well, okay, I better get started. I've got 9 months until the book comes out. You know, I'd sold it to Knopf in like a week, and you know, I better get cracking on the new one. Maybe I can finish the new one before the next one comes out. So I went, sat down in the coffee shop, started with the first line, started writing, started thinking, you know, this sounds a lot like this Jim Stegner, this painter from Taos, New Mexico, who kills a man sounds a lot like my friend Jim Wagner from Taos, Mexico, who once shot a guy in a bar. And but I sort of put that aside. I kept going. And then I started thinking, okay, he kills this guy. This guy is beating a horse to death, and he basically kills the guy and saves the horse. Now, should this guy have a brother and who's bent on vengeance? And I called my editor, Jenny Jackson, in New York, and I said, hey, should he have a brother? And she said, oh, yeah, of course. So I wrote the brother. And then I started thinking, well, he's got this commission for this painting in Santa Fe. He's in Colorado now. Should he go down there to New Mexico and do the painting? And should the brother follow him? And, you know, I was thinking about it. And then I started thinking, I'm thinking. And that can't be good, because the last book, the first novel, I didn't think about it. I just listened and wrote it. So I was going through this whole quandary, and I was in Paonia, Colorado, which is where the painter begins, and I was in the very little tiny coffee shop where my character Jim Stegner ends up meeting his model and then lover. I was there in that very coffee shop. It's tiny. There's one table in the middle of it. You're going to talk to anyone who's in there. And guess who was in there? Paolo Bacigalupi, the great science fiction writer. And he lives in town, but this guy has written huge science fiction books. He's won Hugo Awards. You know, he wrote The Shipbreakers, Wind-Up Girl. And we got to talking the way writers talk, and I was telling him about this kind of, you know, creative struggle. And he's a lot younger than me, but he picked up his coffee cup and he said, sit down, son. And he said, I have to tell you a story. I wrote two short stories. One, I completely channeled, like, fugue state, and I sort of woke up, and it was done, and I sent it in, and it won a big award, and I love it. Second story, I engineered the entire thing. I designed the characters to interact a certain way in every scene. I plotted every second of the story, totally controlled it, finished it, sent it in. It won a big award, and I love it. Now when I hold them both up and look at them both, I can't tell the difference. I love them both. And then he leaned forward and he said, your job is just to make sure it doesn't suck. And the whole creative burden just sort of lifted off my shoulders. I was like, oh, yeah, you know, that is something I can probably do, you know, just make sure it's not terrible. And what he was basically saying was, trust yourself. You've written hundreds of stories. You've written thousands of poems. You know, write it, and then in revision, you can, you know, tighten up the slow stuff, cut out the stuff that doesn't work, move things around. You know, you'll be fine. And what that sort of taught me, you know, and getting back to, you know, it's sort of a long answer to your question, but what it sort of taught me was that every story and every novel may have a different method, and that's okay. You know, may have, you know, varying forms of, you know, sort of authorial control and varying degrees of it, I mean. And so, you know, when I came to write Celine, you know, I began, you know, as I said, with the first line and then, you know, worked into the character. I came to the character of someone who was a lot like my mom. And then, you know, it became apparent that this was a sort of rip-roaring whodunit in a way. You know, it was a detective novel. And so, you know, I would pull back every now and then. You know, I just let it rip and let the characters do their thing. And, you know, they were surprising me all the time. And then I would stop, you know, hit the pause button, and then I might have to work out how, you know, the assassin, you know, intercepts them and where, you know, and I'd work that out for a little bit, and then, you know, I'd sort of like give the horse its head and let him run again. And that's just how I worked. And, you know, I just sort of follow my nose. And when I feel like things are slowing down or the energy's dropping, I just sort of, it is like riding a mountain horse who knows the country better than you. I just sort of give the horse his head and let him find the path. And, it, you know, it seems to work out.
Well, interesting. So the first line then at some point works its way into the book, isn't necessarily the first line of the book.
Right.
So
in the vision, yeah, you sort of, you know, So in revision, you know, with Celine, mm-hmm. I added a prologue, mm-hmm. which, you know, was a good idea.
Yeah, it sure was a good idea. I mean, it kind of sets up the tragedy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So then you mentioned coffee shops. Do you write in coffee shops a lot?
I do, yeah. You know, it's such a writing. Writing is an odd, you know, vocation for me because I'm really gregarious and sort of physically exuberant. You know, I like to be out in the world doing stuff. And to be a good writer, you know, you really need to put in the hours, you know, sitting down at a desk. And so it's always been for me, you know, there's always been that tension. And so the way I sort of solved it, you know, I compromised is I write in a coffee shop where there's a lot of hustle and bustle and maybe even music playing usually. And I found that I could put on those Bose headphones, and I have this app called Simply Rain, which plays, you know, a rainstorm sort of on a tin roof in a North Carolina mm-hmm. forest. Maybe that's what it sounds like. And you can vary the frequency of the thunder. It's awesome. So you're sort of in your own little bubble, you know, anywhere you are, you can just be in your imaginative bubble. And so I don't mind if people are at the next table with their infants, you know, or if there's real estate deals going on behind me or whatever, you know, that's fine. I'm very happy at the coffee shop.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Peter Heller. We're talking about Celine and his other books, The Dog Stars and The Painter. This would be a great time to hear you read. Would you read to us?
Sure.
Okay.
Let's see. Maybe what I'll do is read. How many minutes would you like?
Well, you know, 3 to 4. Somewhere in there.
Okay.
All right.
Let's start with the beginning of Celine. So this is after the prologue. This is chapter one.
Okay.
And this will give you an idea of how, you know, sort of how Celine lives and my mom did too. The call had come while she was at her workbench wiring the naked taxidermic form of an ermine onto a rock beside the skull of a crow. The plan was to have the skinless ermine looking down at his own hide tacked to the rock. Her sculpture had a distinctive dark streak. When Celine wasn't solving cases, she made pieces from anything at hand, which often involved skulls. The year before, the window washer had been fascinated by her art, which was displayed throughout the open studio, and the next day he brought her a human skull in a bucket. "Don't ask," he said. She didn't. She covered it immediately in gold leaf, and it stood now on a pedestal by the front door, looking elegant. And that's a true story. Now she felt like this ermine. She felt skinned and lost without protection. Her own fur had been her family. She had Hank, of course, but a son, no matter how old, was someone to be protected, not the other way around. When the phone rang, she almost didn't answer it, but then she thought it might be Pete calling from up in the heights, needing grocery shopping help. "Hi, Celine Watkins?" "Yes." "This is Gabriella. Gabriella Ambrosio Lamont." "Gabriella," she whispered, trying to place the name. "You don't know me. I went to Sarah Lawrence, class of 82. I saw the story about you in the alumni magazine. Product PI. Gabriella laughed, clear, bell-like. Celine relaxed. "That was silly," Celine said. "I mean, the title. I've never worn Prada in my life. Chanel doesn't alliterate." "Right." Celine closed her eyes. The name was distinctive, and it sounded familiar. Hadn't the girl had her own small story in the magazine about a show of still-life photographs in a gallery in San Francisco? Celine seemed to remember a portrait of the woman and bits of biography. She was pretty, maybe partly Spanish. Her father had been a photographer, too, hadn't he? Famous and very charismatic. The story had interested Celine. "I remember you from an article." "Ha! The exclusive club of the alumni magazine profiles," Gabriella said. "Yes. I hope it's okay that I called you out of the blue." Celine had been in her business a long time. She knew that nobody ever just called out of the blue. They'd been on a certain trajectory for a while. They deliberated. They picked up the phone. They were like the pilots of small planes approaching an airport who call the tower, finally, for instructions to land. What Celine didn't know was if she had the strength. It was 1 year and 1 day after the Twin Towers had fallen. She could still almost smell the char, still see the air gritty with ash, and remember how the wind blew bits of charred financial statements and post-it notes across the river where they fluttered over the dock like lost confetti. She could not have imagined a sadder finale to a grim year. Her younger sister had died that May. She remembered how bright, how tender seemed the cottonwoods along the Big Wood River in Ketchum, Idaho, the morning Mimi left. She had helped her go, the handful of pills, the long kiss on the cheek. How she had walked down the drive, how the leaves spun in the wind, and how when a gust came through, it swept the old trees to a darker green, like the hands of a harpist lifting a somber note off the strings. And then in July, she got word that her older sister Bobby had a brain tumor. It was a flare-up of a cancer 5 years in remission. Celine went to Pennsylvania to visit, to help, and there was not much to do as Bobby died within 3 weeks. It was almost as if the younger sister's death had given the eldest sister permission to take the deep rest she had longed for. And then the first plane hit, and Celine went to her window and watched the plume of black smoke rise into a clear sky. She was riveted. She lived 50 feet from the pier in an old brick loft building, kitty corner to the River Cafe. It was almost under the Brooklyn Bridge, Brooklyn side, 30 yards from the East River. With the windows open, she could hear the current rip and burble against the pilings of the dock. She pursed her lips and tried to get enough air. She did not move. Pete left her alone. When the second plane tore through the sister tower to the south, she shuddered as if it were she herself who had been slammed and ripped. Lying in bed that night while she cried silently beside him, Pete realized that Bobby was the North Tower and Mimi the South. And of course, the collapsing buildings were much more than that, too. They were a burning message that a certain world had passed. Her sisters had been the last of the family she'd been born into. Celine's inner and outer world mirrored each other. And then a little bit later, Celine Watkins was a private eye.
Yeah, that's just great. What a great chapter. You've been listening to Peter Heller read from Celine, published by Vintage. So much more to talk to you about in this last half hour. I'm so curious. The Dog Stars is written in an interesting structure. The dialogue doesn't have quotes. There's sentence fragments. They're run-on sentences. And it is first person. I hear the painter is first person. Celine is third person, a little bit more traditional in terms of there are quotation marks and such. Yeah. And so talk about that. Talk about the first two books, well, at least The Dog Stars, the difference in that structure and Celine, and just the difference for you in writing each of those.
Sure, yeah. So writing The Dog Stars, you know, as I said, I began with the first line, and then it was as if, you know, Hig was talking to me. And I realized a few pages in that this was a post-apocalyptic novel. I mean, so for people who don't know about it, it's set 9 years after a super flu has killed almost everybody and on the planet. And there's two guys who live at a little country airport north of Denver, 8 miles off the mountain front. And one, our hero Hig, has his old dog Jasper. He's a blue heeler mix, his boon companion. And they have an old Cessna, a 1956 Cessna 182. And Hig and Jasper get in the plane every day and they fly a patrol looking for survivors and intruders. And the other guy, Bangley, who shares the airport with them, is kind of a mean gun nut, and he defends the place. He has, like, a sniper tower, and he's a pretty mean dude. So that's how the novel starts. And, you know, I was writing along, and I realized it was a post-apocalyptic story, and I thought, dang it. You know, I don't want to write a post-apocalyptic story. I don't want to write genre, you know? It's, like, my big chance to write fiction. I want to write literary fiction, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. But Higgs' voice was so compelling, and the situation was so compelling that, you know, I kept writing. And then, you know, a couple of pages into it, I thought, you know, if this gets published, it's going to get compared to The Road and by Cormac McCarthy. And you don't want to get compared to The Road. Excuse me, as a debut novelist, no, bad idea. But again, you know, I was so captivated by this voice that I kept writing it, and I realized that it was much different than The Road. I mean, Higg has this irrepressible sense of fun, and it's not exactly joie de vivre. It's hard to have joie de vivre when everything you know, has been connected to is pretty much gone. But he has an irrepressible, he does have a sense of fun and a sense of humor, and so it's very different than The Road. And I was writing it in such a white heat that I think, you know, I couldn't stop to pause and put in the commas and the quotation marks. I mean, it was, you know, I would just double return when someone spoke, and then double return, and then there was, you know, the answering dialogue. Or, and I'd also been influenced by, a couple of books really struck me. Coetzee or Coetzee from South Africa, the Nobel laureate, great novelist. He wrote this book called Into the Heart of the Country, and it's all these numbered paragraphs, and it's about it's essentially about a woman who's sort of going crazy on the veld in a little isolated house out there. But the way the novel comes at the reader is through these numbered paragraphs, and some are very short, some are a page long or two, and it gives a sort of tile-like, mosaic-like presentation, and I always thought that was very interesting, because I thought, you know, reality really does not come at us in a well-ordered, you know, narrative arc. It comes at us in all these little pieces, you know, and, you know, our sense of the world. And so that interested me. And then there was a book I read called Far Tortuga by Peter Matheson, which is just the loveliest book about these turtle fishers in the Caribbean. And there he doesn't attribute the dialogue at all. He, you know, it just sort of flows over you. There's no quotation marks, and there's no signal as to whether something is going to be, you know, narrative action or description or dialogue. You just sort of let it wash over you the way, you know, our impressions of the world actually wash over us. And so there'll be, again, these sort of like tile-like mosaic way of presenting all these bits of the narrative, you know, the dialogue, the description. And then you'd flip a page and there'd be a poem about a flight of parrots, you know, flying over the water. And I loved that. And so I think I had those books in my mind when I was writing The Dog Stars, because I tended to write in, you know, these discrete little sections that are separated by stars. And also, the other thing about it is I come from sort of an oral tradition. I mean, you know, we come from a family of storytellers. You know, my dad is a fabulous storyteller. He's going to be 90 next month. And his brothers were amazing storytellers, my cousins. And, you know, there was a lot of time spent around kitchen tables, and then later when I was doing trips around campfires telling stories. And I think I write my books to be read aloud or to be heard aloud. And, you know, when you're reading something aloud, when you're listening to it, when you're sitting at the campfire listening to someone reading that story, you don't see the quotation marks. You don't see the little commas at the end of bits of dialogue. And so who needs them? You know, just punctuate enough to give whoever's reading it aloud the cues they need to pace it right. And so there's that too. And then I think the third thing is that after I wrote it, I realized, you know, I don't write with a lot of, you know, conscious intention, but I know there's a lot of stuff going on, you know, underneath, you know, and when I'm asleep and when I'm not writing, you know, during the day. And if you think about it, if you're writing a post-apocalyptic novel, you know, you're in a world that's been stripped of almost everything, and of convention too. And so why not leave the language and the writing stripped down and the form stripped down? So it seemed to make you know, contextual sense that way too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I want to say that, you know, the Dog Stars for me was very different from The Road in so many ways, but it ends on such an upbeat. And, you know, there's at the end of the Dog Stars, there's a bit of hope going on. And that poem that you end it with is just gorgeous. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the influence of poetry on your work.
Yeah, that was an amazing experience for me, the end of that book. My first assignment was for Outside Magazine. I was a kid. I was in my 20s. I was writing poetry in my room. I was teaching kayaking. I was delivering pizza. And one day I was skiing with a friend of mine who always, he was a ski instructor up at Breckenridge, and he always got me a free ticket on Mondays. So we'd ski together. And driving back, he said, "Hey, why don't you combine your interests? You know, you're writing all the time. You're kayaking this crazy stuff. Why don't you, you know, write for Outside Magazine?" So when you're young and dumb, you know, you don't know what you can't do, thank God, right? And so I just went down. I picked up a magazine at the store. I looked on the masthead. I picked the name of a senior editor who sounded nice, Laura Honhold, and I called up. And I said, called the 800 number, you know, for the magazine. And I said, "Laura Honhold, please." And the receptionist said, "Just a minute." Then I was in sort of partial shock. And then I heard, "Laura here." And I started talking really fast. And I said, "Look, you know, I live in Colorado. I just had a story published in Harper's, which is sort of true. It was a reprint of a college story in the reading section up front, so this little piece, but it was there." And I said, "I'm a class 5 kayaker, and I think you should send me to the edge of the Tibetan Plateau to kayak this first descent, this river that's never been done." And there was a long, you know, sort of incredulous silence. And then Laura, bless her heart, said, "You know what? I'm going to take a chance on you. We've heard about this expedition. We'd like to cover it. We don't have a writer that can kayak class 5. And I'm going to pay half your expenses. And I'll pay the other half, you know, if you write a good story, and I'll buy the story." So I was so stoked, you know, my paddle was all duct taped up. I needed a new paddle. So I went off on the trip, and it's kind of a long story, but it was all professional river runners. There were a couple of us that were kayakers who were, you know, would paddle out front, and the only two that weren't professional river runners was a couple on their honeymoon. And we're in far western Sichuan, hard up against the Himalayas, against the Himalayan plateau, the Tibetan plateau, and we decided we'd do a training run. And they thought, "Well, we can bring this young athletic couple. They're not professionals, but they're, you know, avid canoers. They're athletic. They're smart. We'll put each one in a different paddle raft, and they'll be fine, because paddle rafts have 7 paddlers." So we went up to do a training run. As we were getting the gear together at the put-in, you could see up against the mountains, you know, it was very stormy. The sky got really black. It was raining up there, and the river began to rise. And by the time we put on, this Class 4 river was now really raucous. You know, it was in flood. And I remember I was surfing a wave, and I peeled off it, and I came around the corner. As it had been warming up, I came around the corner, and I saw one of the rafts just doing cartwheels beneath the ledge, and nobody in it. And that's not what you want to see when you're a kayaker. And so I paddled fast ahead, and in the big heavy waves was a helmet, and I paddled towards it, put my stern towards the swimmer, and we hit a big wave, and couldn't grab my stern. We were being swept into the shore, and there was a log jam. And I hit the shore, amazingly, right above this log jam, clambered out, and this guy went in, and his helmet went into the logs, which act like a sieve, and joined another helmet that was already stuck there in this kind of funnel. And I ran out on the logs, and I grabbed the guy that had been in the water, and I pulled on his life jacket. And the other kayaker was right there behind me, pulled on his life jacket, hauled him across the logs on the shore, and he was still alive. He was one of the Chinese guides. We went back for the helmet that I had seen, that it was, I had already been there, and we pulled and pulled, and we couldn't move him. And We put a Z Dragon on him, which is a pulley system that has a lot of force, and we couldn't budge him. And then we tried to hold his head up, and the river was rising, and he died in our arms. And he was Dave. He was the guy of the couple, and they were on their honeymoon. Mm. And we had to paddle across the river and tell his new bride that he was dead. And the next day, the river had dropped. The storm had passed. The river dropped. It was now a sweet, you know, class four river with a nice rhythm. We gathered by the river. She took his ashes. They cremated him, you know, the next morning, and she took his ashes home. And we gathered by the river, and we sang Amazing Grace. And I had a book of Chinese poetry that I brought with me. I thought on my first magazine assignment, I would bring a book of poems from the place, and I've done that ever since, you know, sort of to get the heart of the place. And I read a poem, and it was by Li Shang Yin. It was written in the 9th century, Tang Dynasty. And we kind of, the Chinese revoked our permit. We got in buses. We drove around in the grasslands of the plateau in a place that no Westerners had been since 1959. There were yak herders up there living in yurts, sort of like the Great Plains 1870, except that these guys had, you know, snow leopard fur trimming their coats and stuff. It was really sort of surreal. And I got back, and I said, you know, I called Laura. I said, I can't write your story. And she said, what happened? For 45 minutes, I kind of vented. I know I was really grieving and probably traumatized. And she said, you go write it. So I wrote it. It was a long piece. It was there. Submission for the National Magazine Awards that year. And it was an odd way to start in journalism, but it sort of launched this career in, you know, writing about adventure and the environment. And so here we come now, you know, to having the time to write the novel. When I sat down to write The Dog Stars a few years ago, I thought, you know, I think I have 9 months now where I don't have to write a story. Let's sit down and write this novel. And so I wrote it in a white heat. It took 7 months. I got to the last page, and Hig is lying out under the stars, our hero. And he says, and my favorite poem was written in the 9th century by Li Shang Yin. It's called, When Will I Be Home? And it was the poem that I had written, I mean, that I had read for Dave by the river 25 years before. Hmm. And I had no idea that I even remembered it. Mm-hmm. It just came ringing in out of the universe, and it goes, when will I be home? I don't know. In the mountains, in the rainy night, the autumn lake is flooded. One day, we will be back together again. We will sit in the candlelight by the west window, and I will tell you how I remembered you tonight on the stormy mountain. Hmm. That is the most thrilling thing about writing fiction, is that this stuff comes out of the universe, and you don't even, I mean, a lot of times I'm writing along and my character is, you know, is saying stuff that I didn't even know that I had any idea about. It's really crazy. It is cool.
What's not cool is that we only have a few minutes left, and there's so much more to talk about. But I want to ask you something that triggered a thought when I found an interview with you yesterday on something on YouTube, and you said something to the effect of, in fiction, the characters are smarter than you are. And I was thinking about that and thinking that, you know, we probably should know our characters even better than we know ourselves. But how do you think that works? How are characters smarter than us? How does that happen?
Because I think when we're going through our world on our sort of normal plane, you know, our pedestrian plane, we're all just trying to get through the day, and we're all just trying to, you know, we all wake up in the morning, and, you know, half the time we got to figure out a reason to get out of bed. I mean, let's be realistic. You know, life is hard. And you know, we're trying to make, you know, what The Dog Stars, I realize, is about. And I think why people love apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic literatures that it throws into relief in these stark, bleak worlds. You know, that's Higgs' problem, and that's everyone's problem is, you know, find a reason to get out of the bed in the morning, how to make meaning, a little bit of meaning every day, how to stay connected to the things we love. And those, you know, they're sort of apocalyptic tales, are sort of parables for the kind of, challenges we face as human beings every day. And I think that's why, you know, people love those stories and can relate to them, you know. They just throw them into relief. And so in our normal world where we're just dealing and trying to make a living and trying to get along and trying to be connected with other people, it keeps us focused on those things. And when we're writing, when I sit down to write fiction, something happens where sort of open up to, it's very difficult to describe, but it's almost this feeling of being transported into this imaginative territory, as I said in the beginning. You know, you sort of get on a narrative current, you follow the river into this imaginative territory, a country that you've never been. There's people there that you've never met. And your sort of heart opens, mind does, and your imagination, and it widens out. And it's sort of, it's this big wide net that's gathering, and open to the sort of the music the music of the stars in the universe. You're listening for that. And so I think it's just because, you know, when I'm sitting down to create that, I'm very, very, very open. And I think it allows those little bits of memory, of reading, of stuff that I read, of people that I've talked to, it allows all those little bits of consciousness, you know, to flow in a way that in our normal world, we're just, you know, sort of our normal day, we're just sort of focused on getting along. And so I think in that way, you know, all these things come back to me that I don't even know that I remembered or can barely remember that I heard. It's very, very wonderful. It's why I just love to write fiction more than anything.
Hmm. Well, nobody writes setting like you. It's really just, you know, setting can go on and on in novels, nonfiction, whatever, and you just go, okay, let's get to it. Come on, let's get to the story. But your setting is very much a part of the story. And I'm going to guess and say that comes from being a journalist, from being a writer, the sort of nonfiction writer that you've been.
Yeah, and it comes first from being someone who loves nature. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm an outdoors person in my bones. You know, there's never happier than in a wild place or knee-deep in a creek, you know, in the evening in, you know, western Colorado where I'll fish every night, just in a wooded canyon where I can hear the knock of an antler or, you know, once in a while a bear will, you know, trot across the creek. And, you know, I'm just so happy out in nature and so I think when I'm writing, I just go to those places where I find joy. You know, why wouldn't I? You know, if I can sort of transport to any place when I'm writing fiction, why not go to those places where, you know, there's deep connection and deep joy? And so I often find myself, you know, out in nature. And I think the ability to evoke those places for the reader comes from, yes, years of writing magazine stories that are, you know, often, you know, set in wild places, and having been trained to gather those little details that can bring those alive for a reader, you know, especially, you know, I think that, you know, every magazine story I ever wrote and every novel, you know, begins with a strong sense of place. And I think that's because in magazine stories, I learned that's how you grab the reader. You know, you transport them right away from the, you know, the doctor's office where they've picked up the magazine to read the piece, or, you know, the coffee table where they've grab the magazine to look at a story. You know, you transport them into a place where they can be completely immersed. It's not, you know, that's away from their normal world. And so I use the senses a lot, you know, all five of them if I can. and I train myself to do that all that time. Yeah. Mm.
In closing, I wonder if there's any advice that you received somewhere along the way that has stayed with you.
Yeah, I think there's three things that I would pass on, and very, very briefly. One is what Paolo said, which is don't worry about the method so much. You know, there's a lot of ways to get at a good story. You know, some people might want to plot and outline. That's great. You know, some people you know, let it rip and then, you know, pull back and then and block it out ahead a little bit and then let it rip again. Great. Some people start with a big idea that they need to research. Great. I think there's, you know, all sorts of ways to get at it. So don't worry about that. Just follow your nose and have fun. If you're having fun, it's likely the reader's probably having fun too. So there's that. The second thing is I write every day. I write 1,000 words a day, you know, 6-7 days a week, and I always stop in the middle. And I think it's changed my relationship to my writing. Instead of writing through a scene and writing, you know, thousands more words a day, I write the 1,000. I make myself write that, but I'll write past it a little bit until I'm right in the middle of the scene that excites me, and then I can't wait to get up in the morning and get back to work. And it's really I became evangelical about the method because it's so great. So all my older friends do it now. And the third thing I would say is, you know, every work of art, I think, begins with a question. And this is something that Joy Graham, the great poet, told me once when I was at Iowa studying poetry. She said, you know, every poem, and I think it's true for every work of art, begins with a question. And, you know, the poem or the novel or the sculpture is the answer. And she said, don't ask, you know, why ask the question of some reader or your editor or your teacher or the critics or some idea of some, you know, audience out there, some market or something like that. Why not ask the question of God? And that really struck me. You know, it's, yeah, aim high. We're only here once, as far as we know. So, I take that very seriously, and I think, you know, in a way, you know, when you begin to write, you know, we should get on our knees and ask the question of something much greater than ourselves.
I love that. It's a great, great way to end. Peter Heller, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure to talk with you.
I love being here. Thanks for having me, Barbara.
You're so welcome. That was Peter Heller. We were talking about Celine, and hopefully he'll be back with his next book, which I think is out in January of next year. Only 11 months to go, right? You have been listening to Writers on Writing. If you want to know more about the show or literary events in the area, drop me an email. You can reach me at penonfire.com. Until next time, thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine.